Well, let's talk a little bit about the externals of the Old Testament first. When people look at the whole Bible as being all about how to get saved, if one's looking from that standpoint, it looks like a tremendous difference between Old Testament and New Testament. You know, when they fit everything into the picture of how to get saved. But a lot of what you're looking at in the Old Testament is what set Israel apart. And that was by design that God had chosen one nation out of planet Earth through whom he was going to work to reach the rest of the world. And it was important that they not just be conformed to the rest of the world. Some of the rules, some of the regulations that one runs into, like you can't mix cotton and wool, are things that you say, well, doesn't look like that was made a rule because it's sinful to mix those two things. But God was seeking to have Israel maintain a distinction. So when we get to the New Testament, in the passage that you're talking about here, it's a very interesting thing when one looks at the beginning of Mark chapter 7. Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, 7:1, having come from Jerusalem. And when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is, unwashed hands, they found fault. And so the question arises over external purity and so forth. Jesus answered in verse 6, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'" What we see is that the Old Testament was aiming not only at the external, but it was aiming at the internal, because the internal was the basis upon which Israel's distinctiveness would mean something. But once people forget about the promises, especially the Abrahamic land, Davidic, and New Covenants, then it just becomes externals. So what Jesus does in this section is to go through and show that the Pharisaic or rabbinic additions to the law actually became their hallmark. It became the centerpiece. And that doesn't set them apart in the way that God was seeking to set them apart. It sets themselves apart in the way they wanted to be set apart. And they were elevating their commandments, their rules. And in that context, in verse 20, Jesus is saying that their speech, all the things that they did that evidenced that they were far from him as Isaiah had spoken of them, is absolutely the case. Now, still within Israel, the keeping of the dietary rules and that which had been written was expected, but without the internal change, it meant nothing. And Jesus is pointing out just how contaminated and how defiled the people who thought that they were the purest of all actually were. Steve, since this is related to Matthew passages,
just one other thing. I think all the way through Jesus' theme to the Pharisees is he is a man of authority who gives mercy, not religion. And so this is a real enigma for the Jewish people. If you have authority, you use that authority to push everybody down. And he's saying you as leaders are misusing your authority and looking to all these rules to keep people pressed down instead of showing mercy as he comes. And we talk about in our Matthew series, majesty and mercy. Here is the one with all majesty, the king, but what he's doing is showing mercy to everybody instead of trying to keep himself up. They're focused on keeping all these rules in place that will really keep them elevated and the people down. Not that the rule was bad itself, but it all was set up to where they could stay up on top. And so his whole focus through those books, the synoptics, are you need to show mercy. There's no mercy here. You're not showing it. And, you know, when they're wanting to eat the grain, it's the same thing again. You know, they're hungry. They need mercy. And when he's in the temple with the man whose hand's bad, and, you know, they don't care about the guy, the Pharisees. All they care about is trapping Jesus. And so they bring him in and say, it's Sabbath. Are you going to heal him or not? Show us that you're not from God and heal him. And it's the whole mercy healing.
Yeah.
So really, the Isaiah passage is really the key one in 7.
I think so.
Yeah.
I've taken off on a little bit of a tangent from this. My whole approach to how I teach the Bible is very much related to this concept. It is my sense that it is very common for people who are teaching the Bible to try to make their own high priesthood, in the sense of making it so that, well, I know Greek, I know Aramaic, I know Hebrew, so therefore you need to come to me. I'm the high priest. I've got this special information I can communicate. I believe instead the way that one should aim to teach is to make it so that it becomes evident that what is being said is coming out of the text. And that, I mean, because it's the text where the authority resides. It doesn't reside in the person who is communicating out of the text. And so that's why I give a lot of explanation for how I get to my conclusions. Because that way you can see, is the text backing it up, or am I just talking on my own? And the Pharisees were very much trying to maintain control. Other questions?
In Mark 3:13, it seems like it's almost a ceremony where the apostles are appointed. The way I read this, it seems like in the other Gospels it's more follow me and become my disciple or my apostle. Was there a formal ceremony at all? The way I read those few verses.
Well, in Mark 2, he had Levi come follow me.
What I would say is, let's go to a verse in John, and let's come back here. I think in John chapter 15, we have two separate verbs. And he's talking about something that had occurred in the past, but he's actually talking about two events. John chapter 15, verse 16. This is in the last discourse. Jesus said, "You did not choose me." He's talking to the 11. "But I chose you and appointed you." Two separate events. "That you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain." Now, fruit is not a good translation here. "That you should go and bear a crop." Quite often, you'll find it translated that way. When you run into the word crop in the New Testament, it tends to be this word that is also fruit. Because if we think about it, an orange tree, we're thinking, well, I'll pick an orange. But the farmer's thinking about his crop, the fruit of the produce. He's thinking about his whole operation. He's got a crop that he can sell. The crop would be the people. So he's saying to the 11, "You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear a crop, and that your crop should abide." Remain is how our translations generally have it. But chapters 14 and 15 of John use the word meno that is translated most all the time as abide, and it should be understood as abide here. It isn't that it just remains or it endures, not talking about security, but it's talking about that as the 11 abide in the Word and abide in Jesus, they're going to be sharing the message of life, and the objective is that their crop, that is, those who believe through them, would also abide in the Word so that they could bear a crop by sharing the message of life. Now, when I had you turn to this passage, he chose them. What we see is actually there's more than one occasion where we have passages that look similar to this. Turn ahead a little further. Actually, I am look at my Greek text. Okay, I did find it. Mark chapter 6, starting at verse 7. Where he had chosen the 12 as the 12, there had been a larger group. And there always was a larger group than the 12 that was with Jesus. But the 12 are ones that he's working with specially to prepare them for afterwards. But notice in Mark chapter 6, verse 7, "And he called the 12 to himself and began to send them out two by two and gave them power over unclean spirits. He commanded them to take nothing for their journey," and so on and so forth. So what he's doing here is he's actually sending them out on practice runs for what they are going to be doing after he departs. What we have in Mark chapter 3 is the selecting of the 12 out of a larger group to be the ones that are going to receive special training and attention by him. But before that, he would call people, and people were there with him. So we end up having a series of different events that he does, because he's gradually getting people ready so he can have the 11 to take on the mantle after he has departed to heaven.
That makes sense. Thank you.
So a lot of these passages are viewed as doublets by higher critics, and they say, why do we have these different passages? But there's actually something different going on in all of the passages that seem similar. And let's back it up even further. We know in Matthew 4 or Mark chapter 1 about Jesus going by the Sea of Galilee and the four fishermen. But at least 6 months before that, we have John chapter 1.
Yeah, it seems like Mark is almost an abbreviated version of Luke and Matthew.
Absolutely. That's the right way to look at it. The normal view that I argued against in my dissertation is that Mark was first. And in my view, Mark is fourth. I almost, not quite, but I almost turned the normal model upside down. John's first, Matthew's second, Luke is third, Mark is fourth. Now that doesn't mean that I have any late dates, because my date for Mark is the date that most people have for Mark. It just is, everything else is earlier.
So John, at what point are the 11 considered to be apostles?
Sometimes in the Gospels we will find references to them as apostles, because the word comes from apostello, which means to send. But when they actually transitioned from the role of being disciples to being ones who were sent out with Jesus not being on earth, we're looking there at Pentecost for the official transition. But since each of the books of New Testament were written after Pentecost, they often referred to them, sometimes the Gospels referred to them as apostles. You know, it's like if you knew a woman when she was a child and you were to talk about her childhood, you might use her married name, but it didn't mean that that was her name at the time that those events of her childhood were going on. And you know, someone could say that Diane Niemela grew up in Silver Lake, Oregon. Well, when she was growing up, her last name was Corum. But knowing what her name became, she can be referred to by her married name, even though that wasn't her name when she was growing up in Silver Lake.
But I could therefore assume there were many disciples, but these were the chosen 11 to be.
Yes, yes.
Yes, thank you.
And so we have in Luke a sending out of 70 disciples for ministry. We always see indications that there was a larger group that was following Jesus, but these are the ones that he selected that he was going to particularly invest his time in.
Thank you.
That leads right into a question I was asking. Disciple, Does that mean at the time Jesus actually walked the earth, or does it still apply today?
I tend to regard it as a term that was most appropriate during the lifetime of the people in the first century. One of the things that we find is that in the book of Acts, there is a point where Acts stops using the term disciple, because we have a lot of years covered in the book of Acts. Acts starts in the year 33 and it ends in 62. And so there reaches a point, because of time and also because of geography, because the focus of the book of Acts, starting in Acts 13, moves outside of Israel. And so most of the people who were physical disciples who physically followed Jesus have either died or at least didn't move outside of Israel. And so they don't tend to be referred to people, believers who are growing, and that you tend to have other terms that are used to describe them rather than disciple. So my tendency is to think that it's largely a first century term.
Because a simple definition would just simply say follower of Jesus.
Well, literally, learner. We have the word mathematics. Mathematics means learning measure. And so, mathetes, which is the word for disciple, comes from a verb that means to learn, and the tes ending is like our English ER. Like we say farmer, banker, and so on and so forth. So, mathetes is someone who learns, or a learner.
So, but in all his feasts, you know, breaking the bread and the fish, thousands of disciples.
Yeah, in the most general sense. Yes.
And then to clarify an apostle, because they're appointed, there's criteria to go along with being an apostle.
Oh, yes. One of them being they had to have seen the resurrected Christ. So there are no apostles today. Questions?
Over Mark chapter 8, maybe you could go over the blind man and how it breaks
sure.
the mark up and
run behind on Mark 8.
Each of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, give great prominence to the events of when Jesus was with his disciples and went to Caesarea Philippi, and we have the confession by Peter there in Matthew and Mark. But Mark has something that has puzzled scholars. And, well, Mark has a number of things that have, but one of them being Mark chapter 8, verses 22 through 26. And we'll read the passage, and people have a tendency to look at that and say, what's that there for? Then he came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and said, I see men like trees walking. Then he put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up. and he was restored and saw everyone clearly. Then he sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into the town, nor tell anyone in the town. There is no parallel to that passage in Matthew. There's no parallel in Luke. And there's no parallel in John. And people tend to look at this and they say, what's this doing? Does Jesus fail to heal the guy? I mean, he has to go at it twice. And the guy says, he didn't heal me very well. And then he used spit. And then on top of that, Jesus said, don't tell anybody. Is Jesus saying, I don't want anyone to know that I had a hard time healing you? I mean, people have really puzzled over this passage. But this is the key to the entire book of Mark. I mean, this passage right here opens up the entire book of Mark. Okay. I see some puzzled expressions. That's good. Okay. Let's go back to 8:1. In those days, the multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar. Then his disciples answered him, how can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness? Now, Jesus had already fed the 5,000. Well, he asked them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. So he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And they set them before the multitude. They also had a few small fish, having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000. And he sent them away. Immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and came to the region of Dalmanutha. Okay, so his disciples aren't real bright here. He's already fed the 5,000, and they're saying, gee, we don't have any food. And not enough for these guys. I mean, what are we going to do? So he crosses the sea. And now in verse 11, then the Pharisees came out and began to dispute with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven, testing him. But he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Assuredly, I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. Now, I've spoken about that issue, but I'm going to quickly say, Jesus doesn't say, I'm not going to give any signs. He says, I'm not going to give signs to the generation. Signs given to this generation would be designed to bring about national repentance so that he could bring in the millennial kingdom. That's already been postponed, so he's not going to do signs for that reason, but he still does signs to bring people to believe. Separate issues. Verse 13. And he left them, getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread. Remember when he asked, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7. Now they're wishing that they had kept a couple back. But they only had 1 loaf with them in the boat. Then he charged them, saying, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Now, the leaven of the Pharisees is getting people involved in all the legalism, and the Herodians were loyal to the Herodian dynasty and wanted to keep the power structure the way it was. They weren't particularly religiously interested. They were focused upon political power. Well, they didn't understand what he said at all. So in verse 16, and they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have no bread. Okay, they're lost. But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Are you still not figuring out these things? Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many baskets full of fragments did you take up? 12. So each one of them carried a basket and they filled it. So that's feeding of the 5,000. That occurred earlier. Now verse 20. Also, when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? And they said 7. How is it you don't understand? Now, when he talks about being blind, he's talking about not understanding. What he's going to do is he's going to give an object lesson in the way that he heals this man in verse 22. And so he's wanting them to figure out a spiritual lesson. So he came to Bethsaida, that's northern coast of the Sea of Galilee, and they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked if he saw anything. Now the man had previously had eyesight. He knows what it is like to see. So he says, I see men like trees walking. It looks like a forest. I can't really make out who's who. I just see a forest, but they're walking. Obviously, he has seen before. And he's saying to Jesus, you didn't really fix me. I don't see very well. I see, but not well. Then he put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up. And he was restored and saw everyone clearly. In a few moments, we're going to see that the disciples are not blind. But even though they are not blind, they don't see very well, but they think they have 20/20 eyesight. Jesus has just made an object lesson. Now, I'll wait until after to discuss why he said not for him to go into town. Verse 27. Now Jesus and his disciples went out to the towns of Caesarea Philippi. And on the road, he asked his disciples, saying to them, who do men say that I am? So they answered, John the Baptist. That was Herod Antipas' answer. But some say Elijah, and others one of the prophets. Book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel is called Son of Man 90 times. So they thought maybe it was a term that meant prophet. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered and said to him, you are the Christ. Okay, Peter can see. Peter's not blind.
And that's why he gets listed number one in the 12 every time.
That's possible.
Almost not the professor.
Then he strictly warned them that they should tell no one about him. So again, we've got this same thing coming up. I'll explain that later. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke this word openly. He's not using a parable. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan." Oh, there's everything wrong with that. We tend to look at it as if he's meaning Satan as Satan. But this word means adversary. It's just a Hebrew Aramaic word for adversary. Anytime a believer tries to lead Jesus, the believer is in an adversarial role. What I need to point out is that word that's translated behind right there, in the very next verse, is translated a different way. It's the Greek word opiso. Let me ask a question. If you have someone that's your adversary, do you want them behind your back? Yeah, that's not where you want your adversary to be. So why is Jesus saying adversary? Go on back here. Well, verse 34. When he called the people to himself, with his disciples also, he said to them, "Whoever desires to come opiso me," and all of our translations say "after." What Jesus is telling Peter is, you've stopped being a follower, you've started trying to lead. And by trying to lead me and saying that I'm speaking falsehood, you have become my adversary. You need to get around behind and start following again instead of trying to lead. Now, Peter's not blind, but he doesn't see very well. Now, the blind man knew that he didn't see very well, and he said, "Men look like trees walking." But Peter said, "I see just fine. I see so well that I know, Jesus, that you just told a fib." So Jesus used that healing to illustrate something very important. Up until this point in the book of Mark, the big question has been, who is this? And from here on out, the big question is, what's the proper way to follow this Messiah? Now, Mark is not written to unbelievers. Mark is written to believers. And the first half of the book is posing, okay, let's cover the bases. Here's who Jesus is. People were puzzling over him. They'd say, "Who but God alone can forgive sins? And what manner of man is this that the wind and the waves obey him?" The big question, first half of the book, who is he? Second half of the book, we have passages like 10:45 saying that he did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. And since he's a different kind of Messiah than people were expecting, it's a different kind of following than what most people thought the following should be. So that little passage, the two-stage healing in Mark 8:22-26, is actually the key to the outline for the whole book. The disciples were not blind, but the disciples did not see very well. Now, I said that I would explain about why Jesus says, don't tell anybody. earlier in the Gospel of Mark, we run into, well, let's go there. Let's go back to Mark chapter 3. One of the things that we run into here within Mark, we also run into it in Matthew, that people were crowding around Jesus so much that as a result of the way that they crowded, it became very difficult for him to even enter a city. We find places where it said he couldn't even go into a city because the crowds were just around him so much. And I'll show you one of those passages. Actually, let's go back to Mark 1, starting at verse 40. There's a leper who came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him and saying to him, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus healed him. And what did Jesus tell him in verse 44? "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go your way, show yourself to the priest, and offer for your cleansing those things which Moses commanded as a testimony to them." The way that the Messiah was supposed to be publicized was that he would do messianic signs, such as healing a leper, which had not happened since Naaman the Syrian back in the Old Testament. Priests weren't used to declaring people cleansed from leprosy. And so the idea was, go, show yourself to them, and then that the leadership would come out to investigate whether or not Jesus really was sent from God. And then the objective would be for the national leadership to urge the populace to believe in Jesus. So with this first healing here, it's a matter of saying, go, see the priest. But what happens? Verse 45. "However, he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the matter so that Jesus could no longer enter the city, but was outside in deserted places, and they came to him from every direction." Then we have the famous story about where the four men brought the paralytic and they broke a hole in the roof and let the guy down. Why? That place was so crowded that there was no room even by the door. Look at what it says about, and you know, this keeps on going. So in verse 20 of chapter 3, it says, "Then the multitude came together again so that they could not so much as eat bread." And then I'm going to help correct your translation. On
chapter 3, you've got a question you got to address.
Sure.
Verse 29.
Okay, very good. In verse 21, "But when his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold of him, for they," now the question is, who's the they? "For they said, he's out of his mind." Now, most people and most preachers, oddly enough, except the Catholics, Catholics managed to get this one right. On this passage, they say that the they refers to the population of Israel, not to his family. "But when his own people heard about this, they went out to rescue Jesus, for there were people who were saying," that's paraphrasing, "he's out of his mind." Well, guess what? Verse 22 is an illustration of people saying he's out of his mind. "And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem said, he has Beelzebul. By the ruler of demons, he casts out demons." So now, look at what happens just a little later in verse 31. His mother and his brothers have come to rescue Jesus. That's what we got the preview of in verse 21. Then his brothers and his mother came, and standing outside, they sent him, calling him. They say, come on out. And he says, no, I'm having fun here. Everyone who's willing to hear my word is my mother, my sister, and my brother. But they're trying to get him to come out so they can rescue him, because they've heard about how the Pharisees are ready to kill him because the Pharisees are saying he's demon-possessed. So, okay. We've talked about the unpardonable sin on a number of occasions. This is a very brief presentation of it in 3:28 and 29. The more complete passage is Matthew chapter 12. Assuredly, I say to you, all sins will be forgiven the sons of men, and whatever blasphemies they may utter. But whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness, but is subject to eternal condemnation, because they said he has an unclean spirit. The unpardonable sin is a national sin. What we have is Jesus, as he healed that man that was demon-possessed earlier in the chapter, Matthew tells us that there were people that were saying, hey, this looks like the son of David. But then the Pharisees quelled that by saying, no, he's demon-possessed, he has Beelzebul, that's how he's doing it. The issue is not at an individual level. Jesus is treating the Pharisees as the representatives of the nation. And what we see in Matthew chapter 12 is that from then on through the book of Matthew, he pronounces curses upon this generation. That generation would face the siege of Rome by Titus. The nation would be put through horrendous things because that generation had rejected the national offer that Jesus had made, and so it is postponed for another generation. When he says it's unpardonable, it's saying this is not like what happened with Nineveh, where God relented from the judgment that was going to happen to Nineveh. Jesus is saying that Jerusalem is going to face the consequences, and there's nothing that will postpone that. Matthew is the fuller treatment, and that's the easier place to see some of the details.
So, John, you know that's a national sin because of verse 28?
It becomes very easy to see in Matthew that it's a national sin because he is pronouncing curses on this generation. And then throughout the rest of the book of Matthew, he reiterates the curses upon this generation. The book of Acts picks up on that, and so that's the context. Mark has a very, very brief treatment, but Mark is not the first gospel. Mark was written after people were familiar with the other accounts. Well, yeah, see. That's involved in it, but here's the thing that's happening. The purpose for a sign was to validate one as being sent from God. Now, as you know, and I know you know because we both have heard the same person saying these things, We know that there are messianic signs, and we know that the rabbis said that no one except the Messiah could cast out a demon in someone who could not communicate. So when Jesus does that, they say, well, on second thought, you could be a counterfeit sent by Satan. So therefore, you are not the Messiah, and you are not legitimately offering the kingdom to the nation. So that's the larger issue. When people have tried to quantify it by focusing upon, well, why is it a matter of, why is the Holy Spirit mentioned, they're missing the larger issue, that what has happened is they're saying, you know, it doesn't matter what sign you do, we're not going to believe you, and we're going to try to get the rest of the nation to reject you, to regard all of the signs that you are doing that are proofs from God that you are the Messiah who will set up the kingdom, that all of those should be disregarded. But it is at a national level, because Jesus is offering the kingdom to the nation, and the national leadership says, not interested, and we're going to come, we have come up with a way of telling people why they should reject you and reject the offer of the kingdom. Now, Arnold Fruchtenbaum has argued this very well in Israelology. So he goes into quite a bit more depth on all of this, but if you, I don't know if you have Israelology. That was his doctoral dissertation at New York University. And so it's a powerful book, and he has a chapter that's devoted to this issue. So he handles a lot of issues that go beyond what we can cover in our time allotment here. We're going to continue moving through Daniel at a fairly quick pace. I think for most chapters, we're going to do them in 1 week per chapter. And giving here an overview of how the book is structured. It's important for us to recognize in Daniel that the chapters are not all in chronological order. Daniel has a different reason for his arrangement. We'll get into part of that in a moment. But here on this chart, which is a reproduction of what you have in your notes, you will notice that Daniel chapter 5, in Daniel chapter 5, verse 31, we have Darius victorious, but it involves the death of King Belshazzar. But lo and behold, in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel chapter 7 and chapter 8, Belshazzar is alive and well. So we have date stamps in this book precisely because Daniel is not putting all the chapters in chronological sequence. So why might he want to arrange them other than sequential? We have a chiasm, and a chiasm is when you have an X type of an arrangement. The Greek letter chi looks like an X. And so that's how it got its name. But notice how I have an A point, and then at the bottom there's an A prime. I have a B point and a B prime, a C and a C prime. This is in the Aramaic section of the book. Daniel is written in two languages. Daniel chapter 1 up through 2:4b is all written in Hebrew. And chapters 8 through 12 are all written in Hebrew. But chapters 2, basically starting at verse 4b, through the end of chapter 7 are written in a Gentile language. They are written in Aramaic. Now, something very interesting about it is that both in the Hebrew sections and in the Aramaic sections, there are prophecies about the future. But when you're looking at the prophecies in the Hebrew sections of the book, you're looking from a Jewish standpoint. And when it is written in Aramaic, in a Gentile language, then you can look at those same events, but they're being viewed from a Gentile perspective. In other words, which vantage point are you looking at it from? What we have is like a sandwich here with this chiasm. We have Nebuchadnezzar having that vision of that great statue that had the head of gold and the upper torso of silver and then the lower torso of bronze and then the iron mixed with clay for the legs and toes and feet. That corresponds to chapter 7. Chapter 7 looks at four kingdoms that are compared to beasts, followed by the kingdom by the one like a son of man. It's looking at the same events as chapter 2, but it's under a different image. So that's why we have A and A prime. Then we have in Daniel chapter 3 that we're going to look at tonight, the fiery furnace. But that corresponds to the lion's den in chapter 6. In both places, there is an attempt to thwart believers from worshiping the true God. And God rescues. And then in chapter 4, we have the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar, where he ends up living outside, having the dew on his back, being like a wild animal for 10 years. And then in chapter 5, we have the humiliation of Belshazzar, in which Belshazzar ultimately is put to death. This is the handwriting on the wall passage. We'll have a lot of fun when we get to that in a few weeks. Because that passage tends to have people wondering, what in the world is this mene, mene, tekel, upharsin? And it's just really funny when one looks at what the Babylonians were thinking when they saw that, because they could make sense of those words. But the sense that they made was nonsense. Mm-hmm. And so they knew that they didn't know what it meant. They knew it was important. And then when Daniel gave the explanation, they were saying, oh, I see. Ooh, that's bad news. So, Daniel chapter 5. Somehow I'm not in Daniel anymore. I don't know how that happened. Okay, so here's the outline of our book, and I'm going to put that up between each of these sections as we move between sections here. First, there's the image, verses 1 through 7. And Daniel's friends are charged by the Chaldeans. Those are the southern Babylonians, the ones that actually were responsible for the Babylonian Empire growing and taking over and absorbing the Assyrian Empire. Daniel's friends refuse to worship the image. Then they're cast into the furnace. They're miraculously delivered, and then we have a Nebuchadnezzar's decree. Now, the first issue that we need to do after I read this is to consider the timing of this chapter. Verses 1 through 7. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, that's 90 feet, and its width 6 cubits, 9.5 feet, or 9 feet. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, and King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now the timing of this is after the chapter 2. We saw when we looked last week that one of the questions that arises at the beginning of Daniel chapter 2 is that if at the end of Daniel chapter 1, let's look at Daniel chapter 1. Let's look at the next to the last verse of chapter 1. Remember, Daniel and his companions have been in a 3-year training, or shall we say brainwashing program, to try to make it so that they will be thoroughly versed in all of the paganism of Babylon, and they would be know the language and would be thoroughly indoctrinated, that they could go back to Judah and be administrators who would be much more loyal to Babylon than those that were left behind of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar. And so they have this 3-year training program, and look at what the end result is, verse 20. "And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm." Well, now we come to chapter 2. And Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And he has this dream over and over again. And he says, "I'm not going to tell anyone what happened in it. I want someone to tell me what my vision was and to interpret it." Because he knew then that he wouldn't be getting a snow job. He'd be getting the real thing. And all of his advisors said, "Nobody can do that." And so then we find in verse 12 of chapter 2 that since no one except the gods could tell this, and his advisors were saying, "We can't," the king was angry and very furious and gave a command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Now the question logically arises, if Daniel was found to be 10 times as good, as smart, as any of the advisors, why didn't they consult Daniel? Why is it that they start killing people and then Daniel says, well, God can give me the answer. I'll be able to interpret for the king. Well, remember, Daniel doesn't put all of his chapters in chronological order. I would argue that Daniel chapter 2 occurred before the final examination, when Daniel was shown to be 10 times smarter than any of the wise men. So this was an unexpected pop quiz, and he passed with flying colors. So you can imagine as the 3 years ends and he goes before Nebuchadnezzar, of course he comes out on top here and so forth. Okay, so we would argue that chapter 2 probably occurred near the end of the 3 years of chapter 1. But now the question is, when does chapter 3 happen? See, we can't depend on, well, it's after chapter 2, so therefore it must have happened afterwards. However, we get a clue within the chapter that tells us that it is indeed after chapter 2. Let's drop down to verse 12. The Chaldeans have brought a charge. They said, hey, you said that everyone was supposed to worship when they heard the music playing in front of that, but now in verse 12, there are certain Judeans whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image that you have set up. So this makes it very clear that it's after chapter 2, because at the end of chapter 1, when their training had ended, that's when Daniel and his three companions were put in positions of power over the province of Babylon. What's the relationship logically between chapter 2 and chapter 3? Well, Nebuchadnezzar is depicted as the head of gold. There in the statue that he was the image that he saw within his vision back in chapter 2. And he was told that there would be another kingdom that would succeed him. That's Media Persia. He didn't know, of course, who it was going to be, but Media Persia succeeded him. And they were represented as the upper torso of silver. Silver is inferior to gold. Then following that, you have a future prediction of Greece coming, representing the bronze lower torso. And that being followed by Rome, the iron legs and the iron and clay feet and toes. Nebuchadnezzar got a big head. He said, I'm the head of gold. So he had this great idea. Well, gee, I ought to set up a gold statue representing all of me in my finest attire, just all gold. So he got a big head. He didn't realize there that he was being pictured as, you're just a man. Your kingdom's going to fail. Your successor's kingdom is going to fail. The successor to that will fail. The successor to that will fail. And then there's going to be a stone. It will smash all of them. And that will set up a kingdom that will have no end. And instead of being driven to, oh, let me find out about that God, he got a big head. So he wants to build this image. Well, there are artist depictions of the image. I have no idea if that's what it looked like, although that's what they tended to make their heads look like. And you say, okay, well, that looks pretty big. Yeah, it does. But now the question becomes, how big is big? 90 feet tall and being 9 feet across. Well, let's compare that with Statue of Liberty. Statue of Liberty, the part that's in copper is 151 feet. But it's standing on a pedestal that's 154 feet. Nobody knows whether the whole statue was 90 feet tall or if it was the size of a known Marduk, that was one of their gods, statue that was 20 feet tall. Maybe it's a 20-foot tall statue on top of a 70-foot pedestal. We have really no way of knowing. But anyway, this gives kind of an idea of proportion that it's only a little higher than half the height of the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty. Now, let's see what it looks like if you look from a distance. This is looking across from the Bronx, looking over toward it. Actually, it's probably on the water. So this is less than 2 miles. If you've got something 90 feet, you can see it, but you know, if you have trees or you have a hill or something like that, it's still going to get obliterated. Well, here we're on the point of land that's as close as you can get to it from New York, and a 90-foot tall statue wouldn't look all that big that far away. So Nebuchadnezzar figures, well, okay, this is going to be really grand, but in India they made a statue that's the biggest one in the world. I forget how tall it is, but Nebuchadnezzar's isn't really that huge, although for his day it was pretty big. When it says that it was on the plain of Dura, this is the site, archaeological site, that Saddam decided to put stuff up on top of it, but and all the archaeologists got mad because he really made it very difficult for them to dig around. But this is the place where they think that the statue might have been put on the top of this hill. That would be a big pedestal, and then you put 90 feet on top of it, so you could see it for quite a distance. So we have a listing here in this passage of a lot of different kinds of administrators, but these bureaucrats that were gathered were from all over the empire. A very interesting phrase that comes up in verse 4, O peoples, nations, and languages. The Bible uses very similar terminology, and you're going to see this at various points in the book of Daniel, language similar to this. It's a way of referring to Gentiles. But Babylon was an empire. It had conquered a lot of people that spoke different languages, had different customs, different backgrounds, and so on and so forth. And Nebuchadnezzar is trying to unify everything by bringing everyone in there to serve or worship the image that he set up that is representing him. Now, the word that's translated here as serve is the word palach. And that word always carries religious connotations. Whether we're looking in Daniel, whether we're looking in Ezra, Ezra has a major Aramaic section, or whether we're looking in Northwest Semitic. I one time tracked down that word in Northwest Semitic, so I looked at a lot of non-biblical inscriptions. It is translated in our Bible, serve, but it's serving within a worship context. This is worship. That And so we've got all of these people. They speak different languages, but he's saying, I'm in charge here. Worship my image. And so obviously that's going to create a problem for these Judeans who refused to eat food that would have been sacrificed to idols. We pointed out when we talked about Daniel chapter 1, they were willing to study the language. They were willing to study the literature. Now, studying the literature, they had a lot of paganism that they were exposed to. When I was in university, I had classes where the professor was expecting a defense of Darwinism. And how did I ethically handle that? I said, in class, you said, the book said. I didn't affirm it for myself, but I could make it very clear. I knew what it was that they wanted parroted back, but I'd always drop in some things indicating that this doesn't look like it's the true account of things. But they were not drawing the line at every single thing, saying, well, we won't do this, and we won't do that, and we won't do the other thing. They were cooperative up until the point that it came to them being required to sin. And they drew the line there. A lot of people will draw the lines everywhere, and they said, we're going to be careful. We're going to pick the things that we can't do, and we won't do them. But we're willing to cooperate as much as is possible. The instruments, we don't have, as far as I have been able to discern, any archaeological information that will help us to identify what these instruments actually look like in some cases. I mean, the psaltery, been told that it's a 20-string instrument. Can you imagine playing a 20-string guitar? I mean, I have no idea what. But so we have wind instruments and we have stringed instruments. And then I do not know the date of this furnace, but this is a furnace that's there within Iraq. And you'll notice I have that inset. If you look closely in the main picture, you'll see that there are two sheet within that. So it gives you an idea. That's a pretty good size opening. You can have a blazing fire in this thing.
What did they use it for? Cooking?
I imagine that they did kiln bricks and things like that. Probably that was one of their main things, because Babylon is not known for having rock. It's known for having all kinds of clay. And they built all sorts of things out of clay. So that's kind of what I suspect that kiln that is being brought into service here in this chapter probably was for that purpose. Okay, so we've looked at the image of gold. So now what we're going to see in verses 8 through 12 is that this brings up a crisis, in that most everybody cooperated, but not Daniel's friends. And so verses 8 through 12, we have the charge that is brought against them. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans, southern Babylonians, the ones who were politically and militarily elite, came forward and accused the Judeans. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Judeans whom you set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, the first issue here is, of course, why are they singled out? Well, it may be that virtually everyone else participated, or it's possible that we aren't told about some others who didn't participate. But it looks like jealousy may well be part of it, because these foreigners have been put over us. You know, here they were just hostages, and you put them over the province of Babylon. They're over us, and they're foreigners. I wouldn't be surprised if jealousy is part of this. But there's a second question. Why wasn't Daniel charged? Is it that Daniel went along? Is it that Daniel was so highly placed that they didn't dare bring a charge against him? Or might he have been away on the king's business? I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's the last option.
You guys really need to watch VeggieTales. That explains all this.
So the text doesn't tell us why it was that he wasn't included, but the possibility was that he wasn't there at that particular time. Daniel hasn't given it to us, so I'm not going to speculate too far on that one. But the charge has been brought. So now that brings up the crisis where they refuse to worship the image, verses 13 through 18. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be immediately cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." So they have taken a courageous stand. Now, that first statement, some of our translations will handle it differently. Is it true or is it purposeful? I think the former is correct, but the rendering of that word, I mean, it's a word that isn't used a lot. Aramaic section of the text doesn't have a lot of words, and that's so it's one of those things where sometimes you're left with a word that you say, what exactly is the sense of this word? But in verse 14, if he's asking, is it true? Okay, these people have told me this. Is it true that you didn't bow down and worship? But if he's saying, is it purposeful? He's saying, are you flagrantly violating this? Or is it that somehow you just didn't hear the message? From the next question, when he makes it very clear, well, you know, if you don't obey this, you're going to be dead. He says at the end of verse 15, and who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Now, he should have figured that one out. From chapter 2, he should have figured that one out. But he's clueless. The testimony given by these three men is God is able to deliver us. There is no limitation on our God. Nebuchadnezzar, your gods couldn't give you the answer when you were trying to figure out your dream, but God gave the answer to Daniel. And God can deliver us. They made it clear that they were going to serve the Lord regardless, even if they were going to die. And of course, the background for this is Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 through 6, the giving of the Ten Commandments, that they shall have no other gods before God, nor any images. And they're willing to die on that. Well, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't happy. That's an understatement. So Daniel's friends are cast into the furnace, verses 19 through 23. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Now we have hot-headed Nebuchadnezzar. And his facial expression changed. I mean, it was like, come on, guys, you're going to cave in now, right? They don't. They stand up to him. They say, no way. And he's not the least bit thrilled about this. He's commanded for the furnace to be made as hot and the fire as big as possible. So who knows what kind of wood they threw in there to get the heat of the fire up higher, but they got it up as hot as they could get it. Interestingly, they were fully clothed when they were thrown in. Very, very commonly for executions, people were stripped naked. It was part of making them feel the sense of shame and so on. So they're thrown in fully clothed and bound on top of that. And then he took some of his choice military people. After all, with that fire being as hot as it was, they were putting their lives in risk. So he's wanting people who have enough courage to go up there, but in the process of throwing the three men in, they get killed. So that leads us now to the miraculous deliverance from the furnace. Verses 24 through 27. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he said, "I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of smoke was not on them. Now, this is going all wrong for Nebuchadnezzar. He was ready to prove that his image and his God and he were superior to everybody. And he's brought in all these administrators from all over his kingdom, and there they are seeing that Nebuchadnezzar is a nobody because he can heat up that fire seven times as hot and doesn't have any impact on the guys that were thrown in there, but it killed his top soldiers who threw the men in. So we find Nebuchadnezzar astonished. And then he sees one like the son of the Elohim. And remember, this is Aramaic. It's not Hebrew. If it were Hebrew, it would be of Elohim. But this is Aramaic. One like the son of the Elohim. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is a polytheist. I don't think he was thinking here the son of the God. He's understanding it, son of the gods. And I don't think this should be capitalized as far as son. I think he's looking and he's saying, wow, it looks like this is an offspring of the gods. Something was unique about the fourth one that was in there. I believe it was Jesus Christ pre-incarnate. Yes?
In verse 26, do you think it's pivotal that he acknowledges the Most High God, or is he being facetious there?
I suspect because he had had the experience of Daniel chapter 2, that it's hitting home. He's not the quickest, not the sharpest pencil in the packet, but I suspect that between what happened in chapter 2 and what's happening here, he's saying there's more going on here with the God of Daniel and his friends than I've ever reckoned with. I wouldn't go so far as to say that he became a believer.
Well, that's kind of where I was going. Is he actually acknowledging that they worship the Most High God?
It is a possibility, but I won't state that dogmatically. It is a possibility. Chapter 4, we're going to see that he still has pride problems and he still runs into difficulties, and then Belshazzar has further problems and so forth, but... Now, it is an interesting feature that we can see that will help to reinforce that he's probably thinking of this still from a polytheistic sense when he says, son of the Elohim. Let's look at Daniel chapter 6, verse 20. That's also in the Aramaic section. Now, let me say something very interesting about the book of Daniel. Remember, we've said that part of the book is written in Aramaic and part of it is written in Hebrew. And in the Hebrew sections, we find Elohim, plural form, referring to the one true God. But when we look at the Aramaic sections, there seems to be a difference between the use of the singular and the use of the plural. In the text that I follow in Daniel chapter 6, verse 20, and when he came out, came to the den, this is lion's den passage, he cried with a lamenting voice, this is the king, to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, a singular form, not Elohim. Has your God, singular form, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? But on the other hand, when we look at chapter 3, verse 28, once again, it's from the standpoint of a polytheistic statement. Now, we notice what the fire burned. It burned those guys that threw them in. It burned what the men were bound with. But it didn't burn even their hair. It didn't burn their clothing. And it didn't even leave them with the smell of smoke. So it's fascinating what the fire burned and what it didn't burn. It even burned their ropes, their bindings. They came out unscathed. And there's no way that that could happen apart from God. I believe that the one who was in the midst there with them was Jesus Christ, pre-incarnate. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar is going to make reference to that, he's going to call him an angel. That's another reason that I would argue that he's not understanding that this is God when he says Son of God. Our English translations tend to say capital S, Son of capital G, God. I don't think that that's the direction that it's going. Well, that leads us then to verses 28 through 30. And here, after the miraculous deliverance, we have Nebuchadnezzar's decree, verses 28 through 30. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word. So Nebuchadnezzar is able to say, well, God is more powerful than I am. He recognized that earlier in chapter 2. And yielded their bodies. They were willing to die, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language that speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made in an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. How often do you notice in the political realm that people try to do something and it backfires? I think that's exactly what happened here, but this is on a bigger scale than we've ever seen. Daniel's friends are blessed because they have obeyed God, they have sought to be pleasing to him. So we've seen Nebuchadnezzar blessing God. He thought that he had seen an angel. He's not identifying the one that he saw as God. And he promoted the three Judeans. We suggested that jealousy might have been part of the reason that the charges were brought against them. These foreigners are ruling over us. And lo and behold, they get a promotion. Book of Daniel is a fascinating book because in addition to the things that we see that occurred during the lifetime of Daniel, we also get a picture of prophetic history, something that shapes our understanding of right now, today, and the hope that we have, the expectancy that we have that God is in control of history, and no matter how much all the forces of this world are arrayed against his truth, he's going to triumph. You know, we're living in a time where we may see things become in the United States much more like it was before Constantine, before Christianity was legal. We have no guarantees during the church age that things are going to continue as they are now, because the church age has had many, many, many persecutions. And there are persecutions going on throughout the world right now. Steve often talks about what he faces in China and elsewhere. And we have to know that our God is going to win in the end. We're not guaranteed that we're going to be delivered from every crisis that we face. But we know that our God will deliver us in the end, even if he allows us to suffer things that Americans haven't normally had to suffer. But this passage is a tremendous encouragement. Stay firm with the Lord. The Lord rewards. The Lord deals with us very graciously, and he's going to win. Steve, you have any comments? Anyone else have any comments?
Just that I'm always impressed that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say he will deliver us, he is able, but even if he doesn't, we're not bound down.
Yeah.
Meaning we don't really know which one he's going to do, but we know what he can do. And we know that he's going to win in the end, and so we're not bound down.
Yeah.
And that's a courageous thing to say. When they've already been, it's not like everything's gone their way. They've already been deported from Jerusalem, and they did have a nice promotion there, but they don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah, they would have far preferred how they thought their lives were going to go. These are royal family members who would have been in positions of administration in Judah and find themselves instead administering a Gentile country, one that had defeated them. But God allowed that because things in Judah became truly awful. Not only was it bad before the final years, but they had kings that swore oaths not to rebel against Babylon. God had told them, don't align yourself with Egypt. But they aligned themselves with Egypt after they had sworn oaths in the name of their God that they would not do so. And God said, you can't do that. You're going to have consequences, and they did. But God was faithful in the midst of all that was happening around them. A truly encouraging book in a very discouraging time. Yes, Keith.
It just strikes me on the idea of free will. And I was thinking which characters in this chapter had free will, and it was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. And something that seems to carry forward is the nature of, if Nebuchadnezzar is an archetype of the world, the people outside of Christianity relationship with God, it just strikes me that in both cases, the idea is you would only worship God under penalty of being cut into pieces and your house being turned to rubble or being thrown in the fiery furnace. And it seems to escape the world why we would have a relationship with God
sure.
with free will.
Yeah, you bring up something that I've often said. It's a fascinating thing when you look at Islam. That it's always looking at the threat. Do this or else.
Yeah.
Religion of peace.
And when you look at legalism, it's do this or else.
Yeah.
But when you look at the beginning of John chapter 10, Jesus said, I know my sheep and my sheep follow me. Now that's a model where the sheep are following the shepherd is going. That's a model of grace. Mm-hmm. But then he says, with regard to strangers, they will not follow a stranger, they will run away from him. Now, we need to stay within the shepherd context. That's the model of shepherding that has the border collies there chasing the sheep to make them go. Legalism chases, and people are constantly running away. But when you look at grace, grace is an attraction. Now, many people decry grace because they say, well, if it's grace and people have the option of following and the option of going the wrong way, lots of people are going to want to go the wrong way and thumb their nose at God. But true following happens through grace. You know, you can't explain someone like Paul the Apostle. If he were told, now you have to do this. No, he wanted to be pleasing to the Lord. He wanted to be rewardable. And that's how grace motivates. And religion in general, but unfortunately too much of Christendom, also buys into the model of you crack the whip and you make people afraid rather than drawing them. And it's a whole different model. It's a whole different dynamic.